This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hey guys, and welcome to Mysteries and Histories with me, your host, Georgia Marie. This podcast audio is adapted from my YouTube channel. I wanted to make my content more accessible for those of you on the go, and we all love a podcast. So if I ever reference anything on screen or a photograph, please bear in mind this audio was originally made for video. It won't hinder your listening experience at all, but just to save any confusion. And if you do want to go and subscribe to my channel, I'm just Georgia Marie over on YouTube. And with that, let's get into it. Hey guys, I'm Georgia and welcome back for another episode in my midweek mystery series, where today we're talking about quite infamous American case, the so-called Oklahoma Girl Scout murders. In June 1977, three Girl Scouts between the ages of 8 and 10 headed off to a summer camp and sadly never came home. This case remains unsolved. A local man was arrested for the crimes at one point, but he was acquitted at trial. And whilst many people still believe he was the perpetrator, just as many people think that somebody else was the one responsible. This case is now 45 years old, and it's easy for cases this old to be dismissed as forever cold cases, but countless historic cases are being solved right now through DNA, new witnesses coming forward, deathbed confessions. In the grand scheme of things, a 45-year-old case really has a big chance of getting solved. The more awareness we can spread about unsolved cases, the better, the more chance we have of them getting solved. The summer camp in question in this case was Camp Scott near Locust Grove, located in Mays County, Oklahoma. The camp had been running for 49 years and was getting ready to celebrate its 50th birthday the next year. A 1946 brochure advertising this camp read, "Whatever you would most like to do in living in your summer home is possible under the friendly guidance and help of your counsellors. Living in a unit with girls of your own age and grade, you have a wonderful opportunity to make and appreciate real friendships." Obviously, this brochure was published 30 years before the camp of 1977, but we can assume the core values of the camp remain the same over the years. Camp Scott was being run in 1977 by the Magic Empire Girl Scout Council. It was a Girl Scout camp, and over the last 49 years had grown to 410 acres of land with 10 campsites, a great hall and a swimming pool. The main road or trail that ran through the land was called the Cookie Trail, and all of the camps sort of branched off of this main trail. To get to the Great Hall, you also had to just walk down to the end of this trail, making the whole camp fairly easy to navigate. On the 12th of June 1977, the children arrived at Camp Scott on Greyhound buses around 2 or 3 p.m, after which they were taken to the various different units. Camp Scott was broken into age groups, 4 different units depending on the child's age, and then they stay in the separate units in tents, with the staff each unit staying in a staff tent. Laurie Farmer, Denise Milner and Michelle Goose, all being in the same age group, were assigned to the Kiowa unit. Once at the unit, they all met in the kitchen so tents could be assigned. The children could decide where they wanted to stay, choosing which tent and which girls they wanted to be with. Once decisions had been made as to sleeping arrangements, it was time for supper, so about 5:30 p.m. they walked down to the Great Hall, where children from across the entire camp would come to eat. As one of the camp counsellors, Dee Elder, would later testify at trial, it was all a bit chaotic, but the first day of camp was always chaotic, it was just the nature of it. She also mentioned the stormy weather that day, saying the rain hadn't started yet as they walked down to the Great Hall, but it was very dark and cloudy. After dinner, the rain would start with plenty of thunder, and all of the girls were sent back to their tents to change into dry clothes and warm up, at which point they all wrote letters back to their families. Once warmer, the children put on their rain gear and gathered back in the unit kitchen in Kiowa, where they sang some songs, ate cookies, and then were sent back to their tents to get ready for bed. Between 10 and 10:30 p.m, the camp counsellor Dee went round and checked every single tent and talked to the girls, making sure they were all okay, not homesick, and warm enough. In the tent furthest away from the rest, there was 8-year-old Laurie Lee Farmer, 10-year-old Doris Denise Milner, who was known by her middle name of Denise, and 9-year-old Michelle Heather Goose. All three girls were from Broken Arrow, Oklahoma, but they didn't know each other prior to arriving at the camp, but they quickly became friends. Laurie was the youngest Girl Scout at the camp that week, but she was very much the kind of girl who was 8 going on 18. She was very mature and acted much older than her age. If Laurie decided she was going to do something, she was going to do it. She was the youngest of 5 children, and I feel like youngest children are often like that, going by their older siblings' examples. For months, she had been super excited to head to camp that summer, but was stuck between deciding to go to a Girl Scout camp or a camp sponsored by the Tulsa area YMCA. In the end, her mum, Sherry, was the one to decide where she was going, and she said, "I'll have to live with that decision for the rest of my life." But Laurie was excited. She couldn't wait to make new friends, just spend a week having fun. On that first night in the tent, Laurie wrote in her letter to her family, "Dear Mum and Dad and Misty and Joe and Chad and Kathy, we're just getting ready to go to bed. It's 7:45. We're at the beginning of a storm and having a lot of fun. I've met 2 new friends, Michelle Goose and Denise Milner. I'm sharing a tent with them. It started raining on the way back from dinner. We're sleeping on cots. I couldn't wait to write. We're all writing letters now because there's hardly anything else to do. With love, Laurie." 10-year-old Denise Milner was kind of the opposite of Laurie in a lot of ways, and actually reminds me a lot of myself. I found researching and learning about Denise quite difficult, and she really pulled at my heartstrings. Denise was a straight A student who had been accepted into the prestigious Carver Middle School, which was known in Tulsa for exceptional students. She was so excited to start at her new school, but nervous. Denise had never been to a summer camp before that summer, but she decided that she was going to go that summer with her friends, selling enough Girl Scout cookies to be able to afford it. She was excited again, but had a lot of anxiety about the whole thing. She wanted to go, but was worried about leaving her mum and her little sister at home. She actually decided kind of last minute that she didn't want to go, she didn't think she was going to like it, but her mum Betty encouraged her to give it a go, hoping it would help Denise's independence. Betty told Denise if she didn't like it, all she had to do was call and she would come and get her straight away. And it was made even more difficult for Denise when her friends backed out of going last minute, so she went alone. As I said, I see a lot of myself in Denise. When I was 10, I went on a trip with my school to something called PGL, I'm sure UK people will know. It's basically an adventure camp, but it's a school trip with your teachers for 5 days. I really didn't want to go, but my parents pushed me to because literally every other student in my year was going. I hated it. I cried the whole time. I just wanted to go home. Denise's final letter to her mum read, "Dear Mum, I don't like camp, it's awful. The first day it rained. I have 3 new friends called Glenda, Laurie and Michelle. Michelle and Laurie are my roommates. Mum, I don't want to stay at camp for 2 weeks. I want to come home and see Cassie and everybody. Your loving child, Denise Milner." The final girl in the tent was Michelle Goose. She had attended Camp Scott the year before and was so excited to head back for another week in the wilderness. Her mum, Georgianne, said, "She was very excited and she came downstairs and she sat on my lap and told me she was going to miss me, but she wanted to make sure I was going to take care of her plants." Michelle loved plants and took a lot of pride in making sure they were well cared for, so she wanted to ensure they were still healthy when she got back. Michelle was also very active and athletic. A week at camp on the move, activities all day every day, was like the pinnacle of fun for Michelle. Her final letter to her family read, "Dear Aunt Karen, how are you? I am fine. I'm writing from camp. We can't go outside because it's storming. Me and my tent mates are in the last tent in our unit. My tent mates are Denise Milner and Laurie Farmer. My room is in shades of purple. Love, Michelle." The tents in the Kiowa unit were kind of in a horseshoe formation, and each tent was numbered, with 1 being the tent closest to the camp counsellors from what I can gather, and tent 7 being the furthest away. It's a bit confusing because almost every single source I read online quotes the tent in question in this case as being tent 8, but from reading the actual court transcripts, the counsellors all refer to the tent the girl stayed in that night as tent 7. So I'm really not sure where this confusion arises from. If anyone knows what the deal is here, please do let me know because I wasn't able to figure it out. In cross-examination of one of the counsellors, the lawyer literally asks her, are there any other units that only have 7 tents in them? Which seems pretty telling to me that the tent in question was tent 7, but to avoid confusion I'll probably just refer to it as the tent throughout this video. The tents in Camp Kiowa, as I said, were set up in a horseshoe pattern. There were 12 by 14 canvas tents set up on these wooden platforms. The tent the girls were sharing that week was partially obscured from view of the counsellor's tent because of the shower block being in the way. It was a 4-bunk tent, but it would only have 3 girls staying in it that week, as one girl had pulled out of the trip. 10-year-old Angela Sweet was also attending the camp with her Girl Scout troop, and they had all been really excited to share a tent, but when Angela got there, the camp director told her that she wasn't going to be able to sleep in the same tent as the rest of them because there were just too many of them. So Angela was led to tent 7, which was apparently quite a walk from where her friends were staying, and she was going to sleep on the spare cot in there. Angela made herself comfortable and made friends with the 3 girls she was now sharing with, Denise, Laurie and Michelle, but then the director came back and told her they'd been able to rearrange things and Angela would be able to share with her friends after all. Because of this, Angela's life would be spared. That night, the counsellors said that after their last checks at 10:30 p.m, they went back to their tent to sleep. And they said that they did have to yell at the kids from the tent at one point, but that was pretty normal. The kids were very noisy and excitable on the first night. At about 1:30 a.m, they heard a door slam over at the toilets, so another counsellor, Carla Wilhite, got up and escorted these children back to their tent. After that, the next thing you knew, it was 6 a.m, and the alarm clock was going off, time to wake up. Carla was the first one to get up. She intended to go and take a shower, but then Dee, the other counsellor, heard Carla yelling for her, saying they had to go and count the kids. Carla went to tent 1 to start the count, whilst Dee went to tent 7. Dee said that she opened the tent flap to look inside and immediately noticed there were no children in the tent, as well as no sleeping bags and no mattress coverings on the mattress. She would later testify that she saw blood on the mattress and a little bit on the floor, but it was very dark and she didn't spend too long looking at it. She initially thought that one of the girls must have had a nosebleed and had gone to another tent, but she realised that something was really wrong when all the kids were counted and the numbers just weren't adding up. Then she heard another camp counsellor, Susan Emery, scream. Dee immediately runs towards Susan and tells her to stay still before heading to get Barbara, the camp director, not knowing that Carla had already gone to get her by this point. Dee describes how she ran into the camp nurse on the way and told her that something horrible had happened, that she thought a child was dead. Dee said she didn't know how she knew that, it was just instinct, I suppose. That, and she'd see some sleeping bags under the trees. The counsellors were told to take the children away from the camp and down for breakfast, during which time the state police were called, and they were all questioned in the main office. Later that day, everyone was also questioned by the district attorney, Beverly Huff, and then by an FBI or Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation agent. The children were also all carefully spoken to see if anyone had seen or heard anything in the night, but no one really reported anything unusual. There would later be reports that one girl heard a scream around 3 a.m. coming from the general area of the victim's tent and then heard someone crying. Not knowing what to do, she just went back to bed. It would also later be reported that around 1:30 a.m. some people heard moaning sounds, strange noises that weren't quite human and weren't quite animal. One 11-year-old girl who attended the camp would later say that a man had been lurking around, and when her and her friends heard a noise and lifted up the tent flap, they came face to face with a man, shining the torch into his face. The man turned and glanced back and walked away, but they didn't get a solid view of him. The body of Denise Milner was found out in the open, not far from the tent, found laying across her sleeping bag, but not covered by it. No one at the scene touched anything at first, apart from an attempt made to cover Denise's body with a sleeping bag so that she wouldn't be seen by the other children as they woke up. Denise was nude from the waist down with her pyjama top pulled up to under her arms. Her hands were tied behind her back with duct tape and she'd been beaten around the face. Around her neck there was an elastic bandage and a cord, which had an object about 4 inches long made of terry cloth attached to it. It was later realised that the elastic bandage had probably been used as a blindfold and the terry cloth as a gag. There were 2 other sleeping bags close by, and on inspection it was realised that both sleeping bags had a body inside. They realised this when they tried to pick one up and it was heavy. Both Laurie and Michelle were in tight fetal positions, curled up at the bottom of their bags. The assistant chief medical examiner at the time was Dr. Neil Hoffman, his job being to investigate sudden, unexpected and violent deaths. He was the one to conduct the autopsies of these girls and write the reports. Their bodies arrived at his office shortly after 1 p.m. on the afternoon of 13th of June 1977, and photographs and swabs were taken. Michelle's body was found with cords tied around her wrists in a double half-hitch knot, the hands tied down by her side with the cord stretching across the back. Her hands weren't pulled back behind her as Denise's had been. Laurie was found with no ties on her body, just ligatures. It was later thought that both Laurie and Michelle had been killed inside the tent, struck with heavy blunt objects in the back of their heads whilst they slept, then their bodies dragged outside inside of the sleeping bags by the perpetrator. The blunt object is thought to have been different for both of them. Denise may have been led outside the tent, sexually assaulted, and then killed. She had been beaten so badly with the blunt object that it left its shape imprinted in her face, but it was not thought that that was the cause of her death. Perhaps the perpetrator, realising that Denise was a fighter and she wasn't going to die, then strangled her with a ligature. Dr. Hoffman estimated the time of death for all the girls to be somewhere between 4 and 5 in the morning, but conceded that it could have been as early as 2 a.m. He also said that the absolute latest the deaths could have occurred would have been 6 a.m, but that was a push. There's a lot of back and forth in this case as to whether or not the girls had been raped by their killer. Dr. Hoffman would say that he couldn't find any semen on any of the sample slides he took, and he announced on the 16th of June that they had not been raped. Sexually assaulted, yes, but not raped. However, at the later trial, another expert said that semen had been found, and two of the three of the girls had been raped, and there's still never really been a solid answer as to this. Dr. Hoffman would also say that he didn't find any latent fingerprints on the bodies. Later, two officers from Midwest City experimented with a new technique of lifting off fingerprints from human skin. So they did this on the girls and found a near-perfect fingerprint on Denise. This was huge, it was a huge step forward in the investigation. Until it transpired, the fingerprint belonged to one of the officers himself. However, at trial, it was testified that there was a fingerprint found on a red torch or flashlight that was found very near the victims, and another fingerprint found on one of the cots in the tent as well. Alongside this torch, they also found a roll of black duct tape, and inside the sleeping bags of Laurie and Michelle, investigators found bloody bedsheets that had been used by the killer to wipe off the blood on the floor of the tent. On the floor of the tent, there was also a boot print in a size 10, and a size 7 tennis shoe print was found outside in the mud. As there had been these heavy rains, the storm the night before, it was presumed that this shoe print outside had to have been left during the night, after the rain had stopped. This led investigators to a suspicion that two people might have been involved in this, a man and a lesbian woman. All female camp workers who had been in the area after the murder had their shoe prints compared, and nothing matched. I don't really think investigators followed through on this man and lesbian woman theory very far, but as far as a possible second perpetrator being at the scene, there was actually a fair bit of evidence that supported it. It was found that the girls had been struck with weapons held in both left and right hands. It was also found that more than one weapon had been used, and two different knots had been used. This could, of course, be a very smart perpetrator just trying to throw police off their scent, but all in all, this was a fairly messy and inexperienced crime scene. No effort was made to hide the bodies, it was a very risky scenario in that anyone could have caught them. A lot of people speculate that this was probably a first offence, or at least a first offence of this magnitude, but some investigators also say that it was clear that months of planning had gone into this attack, it wasn't just a chance crime. It didn't take long for investigators to receive a call that a house on a farm 1 mile west of Camp Scott had been broken into, the home of a man called Jack Schroff. He had had a number of items taken from his home in this break-in, but very strange and random items. Missing were a sash cord, a roll of duct tape, three bottles of beer, and three crowbars. The beer bottles in question would later be found empty on the Camp Scott grounds. Outside the door to the farmhouse, a boot print was found that matched the other boot print found at the crime scene. Luckily for Jack Schroff, he had an alibi and passed a voluntary lie detector test. It really did seem that the perpetrator had just broken into his house and used his things in this crime. Despite him never actually being a suspect, a local newspaper got wind of the fact that Jack had been questioned and ran the story, leading to him getting quite a lot of abuse and being taken to hospital in severe mental distress. He was never a suspect, and quite quickly the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation were able to eliminate all obvious males. Jack Schroff, Richard Day, who was the husband of the camp owner, and a camp ranger called Ben Woodward. Outside of those suspects, there wasn't really an obvious place to look next. Now I want to go back to June 13th, the day the murders were discovered, and talk about how this case was handled in the immediate hours afterwards, because it was pretty awful. As you can probably guess, the children weren't going to remain at Camp Scott after this happened, so that very same afternoon they were all put on buses back to the Girl Scouts headquarters and parents were notified that they had to come and collect their daughters. They weren't told why, just that a disturbance had occurred. They would have known something bad had happened though, I'm sure. The parents of more than 100 girls waited at the Girl Scout building in anticipation for hours, just waiting for their kids to return home. Each parent's heart skipping a beat when each child that hopped off the bus wasn't theirs. Of course, all the girls came back, apart from Denise, Laurie and Michelle. Laurie's dad, Dr. Charles Farmer, would later say that the families of the victims were third on the list of calls the camp's executive director made that day. The first people they called was their insurance company, then their attorney, then the girls' families. From a business point of view, sure, maybe that makes sense, but where's the humanity in that? The camp didn't even really explain to the parents what had happened, just saying that the three girls had been found dead outside their tent in what was an accident, but they didn't mention the violence or the fact it was a murder. They waited for Executive Director of the Magic Empire Council, who ran the camp, to come to their home and share more information. But after waiting all day, she turned up and still refused to tell them what happened. They were covering their own backs, it seems. In fact, Michelle's father would say that they never told him how she'd been killed, and he learned exactly what happened at the same time as the rest of the world by turning on the television. Imagine finding out how your daughter was violently and brutally murdered by watching a news report. It shouldn't have happened like that. Perhaps the council refused to share this information because the law enforcement agencies had ordered them not to discuss it, but the parents deserve to know. If the media knew, then the parents needed to know as well. They were angry, and rightfully so. Shortly after the murders, the Farmers and the Milners sued the Magic Empire Council of the Girl Scouts of America and Hartford Insurance Company in an attempt to hold somebody accountable for the girls' safety. They didn't think the security was good enough at the camp, and that lent towards their deaths. The families were seeking out combined damages of $5 million. This was a whole court case of its own, and really interestingly, a sociologist from Ohio called Dr. Steve Sunderland, who had done pioneering research into the grief of murdered children's parents, said in court that he thinks that the initial denial of any information in this case compounded the family's psychological injury. At this trial, there was also testimony from former campers and counsellors about some strange things that had been happening at Camp Scott in the lead-up to these murders. One counsellor said that whilst the counsellors were at Camp Scott for training earlier that year, she'd reported that someone had been rifling through her belongings. Bizarrely, somebody had taken a donut out of a box that she kept in her tent, and in its place was a note reading, "We plan on killing three little girls." When the counsellor showed this to the camp director, it was written off as a prank. I mean, there's no denying this is a pretty huge piece of evidence that this killer might have been prowling around the camp before. Three little girls did get killed. The camp had been warned and still their security was lackluster. Another counsellor reported that during training she'd heard noises behind the staff housing unit and it sounded human. The camp dog even started barking and growling, but when she called out, no one appeared, although she did report hearing footsteps. Ultimately, at the end of this trial, the jury would end up voting 9-3 in favour of the defendants, Magic Empire, and when the families appealed the decision a couple of years later, the appeals court upheld the verdict. The family never really got any closure here, apart from the fact that Camp Scott never reopened to the public, so no more girls were put in danger. On what would have been Laurie's 16th birthday, her mum founded the Oklahoma chapter of Parents of Murdered Children and became an outspoken advocate for victims of crime and their families. Michelle's father Richard became a member of the Oklahoma Crime Victims Compensation Board and an organiser of a local chapter of Compassionate Friends, a support group for parents who had lost children. The Gooses had chosen not to participate in the Farmers and Milner's lawsuit against the Girl Scout Council, but they have been very outspoken against the council in other ways. He also went on to help the state legislature pass the Oklahoma Victims Bill of Rights. The deaths of their daughters was terrible, but at least something good came out of the pain. But let's get back to the investigation. Sorry, I feel like this script is quite jumpy, but I haven't been able to find a better way to approach this one. There's so many different branches of this story to talk about. On June 14th, the day after the crime, the tent and the platform were airlifted to crime labs for further analysis. The next day, a man living in his car is arrested 7 miles north of Camp Scott, but after questioning, he's released. It's also announced that highly trained tracking dogs were being brought in to help analyse the crime scene, and they arrived the next day on the 16th. It's indicated by the dogs that the perpetrator would have walked right past the counsellor's tent in order to reach the girls that night. In the search, glasses and a glasses case were also found, later found to belong to Carla Wilhite, one of the counsellors at Kiowa. She'd kept these glasses and the case in her crate in the counsellor's tent and realised they'd gone missing when they were eventually escorted back to the tent to get their belongings and it wasn't there anymore. Somebody had gone into the tent and for whatever reason, taken her glasses. On June 18th, the local sheriff publicly announced that the murder weapon had been found, a crowbar with apparently 3 solid fingerprints on it. But interestingly, neither the DA nor the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation knew what the sheriff was talking about. Meanwhile, the dogs are still out searching. Then investigators get wind of a rumour flying around that a local medicine man had put a curse on the investigation and on the dogs, that the dogs were going to die soon. It just so happened that later that very same day, one of the dogs would die from heat stroke, and a couple of days later, another would run out into heavy traffic and is struck by a car. Weird coincidence or not? On June 19th, the Mays County District Attorney, Sid Wise, announces that the sheriff had been wrong when he said they found the murder weapon. He also tells the press that there are no suspects in this case. The sheriff says there is one suspect. The Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation says there are 3. Really seems like there was a severe lack of communication between the different investigative channels in this case. The next day, DA Sid Wise says there are several suspects and a mountain of evidence. On June 22nd, it's announced that 2 photographs were found with 3 women pictured in them. Again, the information around this photograph is very contradictory. Some sources say they were found in a cave about 2 miles from Camp Scott, and others say they were found near the girls' bodies. Then it's announced that the 2 photographs were developed by a native man called Gene Leroy Hart, who, from what I can figure out, had been on investigators' radars for a few days already by this point. It's also reported that a man believed to be Gene Hart had been seen hanging around near Camp Scott. This launches a full-scale search for him. And this was huge news because Gene Hart had once been a well-known local figure. He had been a high school football hero who had been well-liked by everyone who knew him. Which makes it a bit of a surprise that at this time, Gene was actually supposed to already be in prison, having been convicted of kidnapping and raping 2 pregnant women, as well as 4 counts of first-degree burglary. But in 1973, so 4 years earlier, he'd actually escaped from prison and had been in hiding ever since. A lot of sources would make you think that the authorities simply zoned in on Gene because he was a native man, he was Cherokee, and they were racist. And of course, that probably would have been part of it. But in all honesty, they did have reason to think that Gene could have been involved. He was definitely somebody they wanted to question. They'd been working under the assumption for a while that this crime had been pre-planned for many months. Whoever was responsible had clearly been waiting for Camp Scott to start up, and the fact that he wasn't seen, well, was it sheer luck or intricate planning? When Hart committed his previous crime, it was found that he'd planned it months in advance, and although the women did survive the ordeal, he didn't have plans to let them out alive. He took the women deep into the woods to hold this attack and ended up abandoning them by a small pond. At one point, the search dogs had alerted at this very same pond in the Oklahoma Girl Scout case. Another fact about Gene that caught investigators' eyes was the fact that he'd tried on the women's glasses at one point in his previous attack, for reasons unknown. You may remember that Carla's glasses have been taken from her tent. Could this be a weird kink? Also, Gene Hart had lived in the immediate area his whole life. He knew it well, he knew the hiding places. He made a good suspect in investigators' eyes. So a manhunt commenced to search for him, with over 200 law enforcement officials and over 400 volunteers from the public. This search ended in chaos, with several volunteers bringing firearms they weren't supposed to have, and many more acting as if it was just some fun day out, getting so drunk they hindered the search. The police ended up arresting many of these people. At the same time, the American Indian movement were closely monitoring the situation. They felt like Gene had been racially profiled because he was Native, a member of the Cherokee Nation. Gene's mother said that law enforcement had planted the evidence and the sheriff was corrupt. Perhaps they'd made the connection to his earlier crime and the fact he was an escaped convict and just thought he would be a great scapegoat. They could close this very high-profile investigation and look good in the eyes of the public. And honestly, there's no reason to think that this wasn't what investigators did. We've got plenty of evidence back on this channel of law enforcement doing this exact thing, framing people, making them scapegoats. Who's better to do this to than a Native American man? But did they actually do it? We don't know. On July 6th, the director of the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation said at a press conference, "I would say with certainty that Hart is guilty, because I would not say with certainty that any person who has not yet been tried were guilty. But we do have a great deal of evidence in this case that points to his guilt." At the same time, a $15,000 reward is offered by the Girl Scouts for the capture of the person responsible for this crime. By this point, investigators had gathered all of the evidence they needed from Camp Scott, so they'd left it in the care of a private security firm. On the 6th of July, a security guard spots somebody in a bush and goes to investigate, but there's no one there. When he returns back to the camp director's office where he had been situated just moments beforehand, he found a bag on the step. Inside was a pair of wet shoes and socks, later determined to have been Denise Milner's. So investigators head back to the camp and they take a look inside a cave they found near the camp. On the wall was a note, 77617, the killer was here, bye bye fools. For months, there was no sign of Gene Hart, but in April 1978, investigators received a tip that Gene was hiding away with a Native medicine man called Sam Pigeon, about 45 miles from Camp Scott. Sure enough, that's where they find him, and he's arrested on the spot for 3 counts of first degree murder. Interestingly, it's noted that he was wearing women's glasses at the time of his arrest. And honestly, in all of my research, it doesn't seem like investigators really covered any other angles in the time it took to find Hart. They were very tunnel visioned in on him. He was the one who did this and they were going to find him. It took a while for the trial to take place in this case, as jury selection was a long and arduous process. They had to find people who weren't really aware of this massive media case and find people who weren't biased. It was a very hard job. Eventually they seated 6 men and 6 women after more than 100 people were examined and rejected. All the jurors were white, blue-collared workers and were sequestered for the entire length of the trial, which finally began in March 1979, with the sheriff announcing that he was 1,000% certain that Gene Hart was guilty. Much of the state's evidence against Gene had actually been gathered after his arrest, and it was said to be highly circumstantial stuff. Taken from a New York Times article, much of the state's case is expected to turn on expert scientific and forensic testimony. Garvin Isaacs, the principal defense attorney, told the court last week that his client was at a disadvantage because he had no funds to pay for other expert witnesses to rebute the state's evidence. The main contribution to Mr. Hart's defense has been a grant of $12,500 from the Cherokee Tribal Council. There was a lot of support for Gene from the local community, particularly among the other Cherokee people, and they took it upon themselves to raise the money for his defence. They didn't think he was guilty of this. The two biggest pieces of evidence the state had, though, were hairs and semen recovered from the girls' bodies that were similar to samples taken from Gene after his arrest. Note that I say similar, not exact. The samples of sperm taken from the victims' bodies and from Gene's underwear revealed very definite similarities, including nearly the same percentage of malformed sperm. Some other points made by the prosecution included masking tape found on the torch found near the bodies was the same as from a pastel roll of tape found at Jean's isolated boyhood home. Crumpled photographs found 2 miles from Camp Scott were printed by Hart 10 years earlier. A small pipe and mirror recovered at the shack where he was hiding away were apparently missing from the trunk of one of the counsellors. All sounds pretty damning, right? But the defence said that the evidence had been planted, the investigators wanting a scapegoat in a native man, and that it is impossible to positively identify a victim through comparisons of hair and sperm. The defence also tried to argue that the actual perpetrator was another man called Bill Stevens, who was linked to the crime by 5 witnesses and was now an inmate at Kansas State Prison. Stevens was eliminated because his hair didn't match samples found on one of the victims. But one witness said that she'd loaned Bill Stevens' torch about a month before the murders, and that was the exact torch found next to the bodies. She also said that he appeared at her home the morning of the killings with red stains on his boots and scratches on his arms. And remember the Girl Scout who said she opened the tent flap and came face to face with a man? She identified that man as Bill Stevens. Whilst waiting for the jury's verdict, Jean answered some questions about himself in a news conference, in which he said he was a deeply religious man, describing his religion as a blend of Christianity and the ancient and traditional Cherokee religion. He said that he didn't endorse the theory that he'd be made a scapegoat, saying that prejudice isn't always open and obvious. Sometimes it takes the form of subconscious attitudes that are the motivation for the way some people relate to other people. You can look all around you. This is Indian country, but it's obvious who owns the land. We have nothing left but our freedom and our dignity. The trial came to a close on the 29th of March, with the jurors reviewing the case for 4 hours before deciding to sleep on their decision before giving it to the court on the Friday. Jean Leroy Hart was found not guilty on 3 counts of first-degree murder. One juror said there had never been any problems, everyone was in agreement that Jean could not be found guilty of these crimes, which likely would have brought the death penalty if he was. It said that Jean put his head in his hands and sobbed as the verdict was read out. People, especially the investigators involved in this case, were in shock. Everyone thought it was a given that he was going to be convicted for these crimes. The sheriff said to the press that he was shocked and disgusted and immediately said that he didn't intend to reopen the investigation, believing they already had the man they were after. This was backed up by the Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation, who confirmed there were no plans to renew the investigation in light of the innocent verdict. But an innocent verdict did not mean that Jean was now a free man. In case you'd forgotten, he's still been convicted of kidnapping and rape and had over 300 years of that sentence left to serve, so back to prison he goes, the Oklahoma State Penitentiary. On June 4th, 1979, at the age of 35, Jean Hart collapsed and died of a heart attack after exercising in the prison yard. This case is one that is still very divisive today. The Oklahoma State Bureau of Investigation still believe that Jean was guilty and continue trying to prove it to this day. In 1989, DNA testing was conducted on the samples from the scene that showed 3 out of 5 probes matched Jean's DNA. However, statistically, DNA from 1 in 7,700 Native American people would obtain these results. It wasn't conclusive. So in 2008, they try again, conducting new DNA testing on stains found on a pillowcase. But it turns out the samples were too deteriorated to obtain a DNA profile, and so again, these results were inconclusive. In 2017, the latest Mays County Sheriff raised $30,000 so the evidence could once again undergo DNA testing. But it wasn't known if he was trying to prove Jean's guilt or if he was just trying to get any lead that could potentially lead to another suspect. This fundraising happened 5 years ago now and I can't find any more recent updates on this, so either they're still trying to get the testing done, it's in progress, or the samples really are just too deteriorated to provide any new information. The families of the girls are still waiting for answers, and with modern technology, these answers could well come eventually. There's always hope, even in older cases such as this one. The fact that this is still spoken about so much today hopefully means that people will follow this through to the very end until they have an answer. The most important thing is getting justice for the families, answers and closure. It's been over 40 years. They deserve to rest knowing that somebody has paid for the murders of their daughters, Laurie, Michelle and Denise. Laurie's mum, Sherry Farmer, said to People in 2018 that she believes that Gene may have been guilty, but she isn't sure that he was the only one involved in the killings. And the evidence does point to two people. I think if investigators hadn't been so narrow-minded in their hunt, maybe they could have provided more answers to that question. Do I think Gene Hart is guilty? I don't know. Based on the evidence the jury had, mostly circumstantial, I don't think I would have been able to convict him, but I don't necessarily think that means he didn't do it. That's just how the justice system works. Is it better to imprison a man for a crime he didn't commit, or let a man go free for a crime he did? There's no good answer to that. But this story isn't about Gene Hart, it's about Laurie Farmer, Denise Milner and Michelle Goose. They deserve justice and I hope with every part of me they get it one day and hopefully one day soon. Thank you so much for watching and I will see you in the next one. Bye guys.